It's wisdom. If you have to pick out one word that the book of Proverbs is about, it's about wisdom. And it's not talking about the wisdom that a man accumulates as he goes through life and learns how to invest money and to win friends and influence people and becomes wise in the ways of the world where he can become a president or a king or a rich banker or eminently successful or prominent or a great writer or a great poet. A man, there is earthly wisdom. And earthly wisdom will accomplish an awful lot for you in this life. But it won't accomplish much for you in heaven at all. Now, spiritual wisdom comes from God. And the first thing you have to do if you want the book of Proverbs to benefit you is what I had to do when I started studying. And it's one of the reasons that I have never preached much about it. You have to say to yourself, I don't know zip, even though you think you do. And you have to start looking at the contrast that God makes, and you have to start trying to sense by His Spirit where you fall short and how you can acquire this wisdom. The wisdom is understanding the Word of God, the proverb, and saying, okay, that's not quite the way I think, but that's the way I ought to think. And I'm going to try to think that way and change the way that I look at things that apply to God. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. And it's something that I'm just going to have to keep doing as long as I live. Because the more you change your idea of what wisdom is and say, okay, God knows what He's talking about. Now I'm going to do that. The better off you're going to be, and the better off the people around you are going to be. And in Proverbs, another aspect of this wisdom is, if I get this wisdom and my children see it in me, and they see what God has taught me, and they see it reflected in my life, then I have wisdom, and I have accrued wisdom that will benefit my children. And when I'm gone, they'll say, you know, Mom was pretty wise. Dad was pretty wise. And you will have taken God's wisdom that He gave you and used it to benefit your children. So we're going to go through these six things that the Lord hates. Seven are an abomination to Him. That expression is a Hebrewism. And it says, six are bad enough, and the seventh makes a complete abomination. It says, these six things are bad enough, but He says the seventh, when it's put in, makes them an abomination. And the expression six and seven, or sometimes you'll see seven and eight, or seven and eight, what it says, are more than enough to be an abomination unto Him. It does not mean that there aren't other things that aren't an abomination to God. This is not all inclusive. But He's saying, these six are an abomination. And if all seven of these things are true, He said, that's more than an abomination. So He's making a point about the excess of different things and how when they're all blended together, there's more than enough here, He says, to be an abomination to God. But He doesn't say they're the only ones. A proud look. It really means haughty eyes. And you've seen this in reality. I call it the peon look. Like, don't worry, one day you'll get there like me, and one day you'll have all this knowledge and all this understanding, and one day you'll be as competent and as impressive as I am. God hates that. And the actual proud look, I don't use anything but the King James translation, don't have to, but it's a proud look. In the Hebrew, it means haughty. Well, what does haughty mean? It means proud. In Proverbs 30:13, he says, there is a generation. Oh, how lofty are their eyes. And their eyelids are lifted up. They're not lifted up to heaven. They're lifted up to their own achievements, their own abilities, their own expertise, and their own station in life. They're doctors, lawyers, merchants, and chiefs. That doesn't mean that doctors, lawyers, merchants, and chiefs don't have a lot of real fine Christian brethren among them. They do. But these people are impressed with their ability to do things. And it doesn't matter what profession they're in. There's nobody else that is as good at what they do as they are. You should be proud of your work. You should do the very best you can. You should be the best at what you do or attempt to do so. But when you cross the line, it's when you think you're the best. And everybody else can't teach you anything. How can you ever gain any wisdom if you will not accept instruction from other people that you may consider to be at a lower level than yourself? I've learned a lot more from humble people than I ever did from proud and haughty people, because their very outer veneer is an inner reflection of themselves, and it's made me see my own corruption and lack of humility. Now, he says there's a generation, and oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. Well, I hate to sound like all the other preachers. No, I don't. No, I don't. But this is that generation. This is that generation. They are so tied up in themselves that they don't have God. And they are so tied up in finding ways where they can achieve some inward happiness and peace and satisfaction, they don't have time for God. The generation that followed me, I remember quite well. They said, we want to find ourselves. We want to find who we are. We want to find ourselves. My generation, we wanted to find ourselves. And when we looked and were honest with ourselves, we found Jesus. And we found the solution to our problems, many of us. But many today never find Jesus. And they go through life. They're haughty. They're arrogant. They don't obey their parents. They think their parents don't know anything. They don't respect the attitude of their parents. They don't respect the general demeanor of their parents. They don't have any respect for them at all. That's a godless generation. Charlie has a lot of respect for his dad. And Norma had a lot of respect for her dad. And all the trustees had a great deal of respect for their dad. And you can pick a family out that's not haughty and arrogant by the respect they have for their parents and the love they have for their parents. And so in Proverbs, it tells us, don't be haughty. Don't ever think of yourself as being more important than someone else or at the top of the heap, or that really the other people need to be learning from you and you don't need to be learning from them. Psalm 18:27. For thou wilt save the afflicted people. I suppose if you take that word afflicted, it means a heavy burden, a heavy load. And when we're young and God's Spirit deals with us, we're afflicted. We're afflicted in our conscience, and it's just like we just can't find any rest and peace. And we don't have a high opinion of ourselves. And we need help, and we're confused. We're mixed up. We know, we come to believe there's a heaven and a hell. And finally, we come to realize that those are the very kind of people that Jesus saves. If you have the attitude of a haughty eyes, a proud look, what in the world do you need Jesus for? You've got yourself. That's what the Pharisees had. Self-righteous. But thou wilt bring down high looks. How many of these CEOs, these high executives, in all these different massive corporations, how many of them have ridden high and mighty And they're smart. They're intelligent. They're quick. And they're nimble. But the problem with haughty eyes, a proud look, is that it has to be brought down. And most of the time, it's brought down in this life. But I assure you, if it isn't brought down in this life, it will be in the life to come. And it might be brought down in a very terrible place. Proverbs 21:4. And high look, same thing, a proud heart. Jeremiah said, the heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. Who can know it? That's the kind of heart I was born with. And you say, well, who'd you kill? Nobody. Did you burn down the Sterling Department Store? No. I was just born with a heart that was naturally deceitful and wicked. You say, well, I'm sure glad I wasn't born with a heart like that. Well, that's your problem. You got a proud and haughty look about yourself. You were born just like that. And then, what happened? Well, a proud heart. The heart, that expression, is a difficult thing to describe. I've studied that for years. I think I have the right answer. But if you don't agree with me, don't worry. I know I could be wrong. I believe the heart is made up of the soul and the spirit. And I don't believe the spirit is capable of sinning at all. I mean the new spirit that God gives you by the new birth. I think in a saved man, you have a perfect spirit that was given you at the new birth that does not sin. And then you have a flesh and an old nature in it that doesn't want to do anything but sin. And when you get saved, God seals your soul with your spirit, and he will not unseal it until the day of redemption. And your soul is heaven bound from the instant it receives Christ. And for the rest of your life, the sun's going to rise, and each day you're going to have to fight a battle. And guess who's going to fight the battle? Well, it's going to be Christ inside you fighting against your flesh, and it's going to be you in no man's land in between, trying to decide which master to follow. No man can serve two masters. Either he will love the one or hate the other. But you cannot serve God and mammon. Hardest thing in the world is for a person to decide which one he's going to serve. And it doesn't mean that after God finally gets you to realize how important it is to serve him, that for the rest of your life, you never, ever, for one teeny, tiny, wincy second, follow anything but the Spirit. I wish it were that way. But you do at times. What happens when you do? Man, you get to feeling so guilty, you want to go crawl in a hole. And you immediately run to the Lord, and he forgives you. That is serving God. If you quit running to God, you've sold out to the master that God delivered you from. And it's a miserable existence. It's a form of self-punishment while you're waiting for the resurrection. And the plowing of the wicked is sin. What's the plowing of the wicked? Well, a high look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked. The word that's used there for plowing is like a light, but plowing's just fine. It means the man who is wicked, and he plows, and he plows, and he plows, and he turns the match mules around, and he plows some more. And he plows and works all of his life, whether he's planting crops or whether he's planting ideas, whatever he's planting, he's going to reap from it. And he's going to reap a crop. God says, now listen, you can have a high look, and you can have a proud heart, and you can reap a crop just like the wicked. But he said, that is sin. He said, you don't want to reap a crop like a wicked man. I had a fella that I won't tell you his name, and he told me that he had a relative who got tremendously upset if one little bit of anything he possessed was ever given to the church that he gave to any of his children. He was fanatical about it. I mean, absolutely fanatical. And he continually ridiculed God and everything that had to do with it. That was his money. That was his house. Those were his works. He has a high look and a proud heart toward God. A man who has a humble heart, or a woman who has a humble heart toward God, will give as much as they're able to give to God, and they won't look upon it as theirs. You know what happens? When a person looks upon their money as mine, 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 mine. Same thing used to happen to me when I would grab a toy away from some kid that was visiting us and say, mine, 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 mine. And my mother would give that toy to that kid. And sometimes the kid would just take it home and I'd never see it again. And if that's what you do with your life, and if you're a crop, you think you're so great at what you do, and it's all yours, that's sin. So we don't want to have a proud look. We don't want to have haughty eyes. Okay, I've preached that to you tonight. I looked up the words. I tried to show you what I believe it means. I benefited a great deal from that. Because as I prepared this, I thought, boy, a lot of your ways are just like that, Tom. You think you have too high opinion of yourself as a preacher. You say, well, what am I going to do about that? What are you going to do about it? I'm going to try to do better. And you know how many times I asked God to forgive me when I went through preparing this thing. Because I'm guilty. But how can you ever get any wisdom or do any changing unless when you prepare it, you believe it enough to proclaim it to others so they can benefit it from it like you did? A preacher that never benefits from the things he studies in the Word ain't worth the powder to blow him to kingdom come. Ephesians 4, 2. Now let's take it over to the New Testament. Ephesians 4, 2. The high look, the haughty eyes. With all lowliness and meekness, with long suffering, forbearing one another in love. Many of you here had loving parents. Some of you may not have. You were born with the same kind of heart that everyone else is born with. Deceitful, sneaky, knowing how to turn the truth around so your parents won't thank you, knowing how to say things that will get you off the hook. But today we don't believe in spanking children anymore. I don't believe in beating them to death. And I don't believe in spanking them unless they know what they're being spanked for. I certainly don't believe spanking them just because I got mad. And I have when I was young. And I'm afraid a lot of times our discipline of our children, we do it in irritation. And when we just have had enough. And they're not quite sure what we're spanking them for. That's not what God wants at all. And sometimes I think we spank them because we're at somebody's house and they act up. So we want to show that person there, look, I'm a godly preacher. My kids do what I tell them. And we yank them up and spank them. And the kids think to themselves, Daddy never does that when we're at home. How come he's spanking us here? And it's difficult for them to understand. If you're going to spank a child, they need to know exactly why you are spanking them. And now, I'd like for all of you adults here, particularly you that are up in my age bracket, or 50 or maybe 40 up to up to, I want to include you, Geraldine, at 89. Now, remember your parents? You ever get so mad you could just kick a bolt? Kick a tire? Oh, you didn't let them know it. Oh, no, you didn't let them know it. But now, do you realize that they did it so you wouldn't have a proud look, so you wouldn't have haughty eyes, so you wouldn't have such a high opinion of yourself? Jesus said, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly, and you shall find rest unto your souls." He was long-suffering. Think of all the things he put up with you. Now, just for a moment, think of all the things your parents put up with from with you. And understand they did it in love. If you had good parents, that was the case. And I think you know whether you had good parents or not. Now, when you became God's child, and when I became God's child, I became responsible to God to get wisdom. And the first thing I had to admit was, I don't have any. And when I started studying, God gave me a good mind. And I'm straight A student. I'm all that good stuff. And I had a lot of intelligence. God gave it to me. I had a quick mind. Don't have any more. I can't even determine when to dismiss it. That goes out the window. But wisdom. I thought wisdom and intelligence were basically the same thing. That was the first mistake I ever made. Wisdom doesn't have a whole lot to do with IQ. Wisdom has everything to understanding that there is no IQ like God's. And God knows what wisdom is. And God tells you to ask him for it. And he wouldn't tell you to ask him for it if he didn't want you to have it. You need wisdom, and I need wisdom, in our everyday lives. We need it every day when the sun comes up and every day when the sun sets. And we need to be seeking it out of God's Word. We need to be looking at the way Jesus did things, the way Jesus said things. And we need to be looking at his life and our own. And above all things, I'll tell you one thing that marks a person's wisdom. It's how much he learns or she learns to love God and to follow his instructions and to do what he wants. That's rare wisdom. And it doesn't come overnight. God doesn't give it to you all in one big lump. It's something you learn from his Word. Day by day, month by month, year by year, assembly by assembly. And God puts preachers down here and he puts teachers down here. And he puts deacons down here to teach you and set an example. I think this church has a good deacon. I think he's a good example. I look here across this audience and I don't see a bad example out there. I think all of you have the potential to get a lot of wisdom from God. And the one thing a pastor wants is for a church not only to be saved, scripturally baptized, and attending, but he wants them to be wise, because he'll use that wisdom, and the body as a whole can come to the right conclusion. And so it's now 1 minute of 7. And you know what? I only got the first abomination.